Welcome to the Student Press Law Center podcast, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit source of information and advocacy for the student media, and we work to break down the barriers that prevent college and high school journalists from doing their best work. For more information about the center, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lomonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. 42 years ago, the Supreme Court confirmed that the First Amendment right to freedom of speech does not end with the start of the public school day. The court's pronouncement in that case, Tinker versus Des Moines Independent Community School District, was based on the conviction that students are full-fledged American citizens and that the government cannot tell its citizens what to think, believe, and say. Well, that was 1969, and the history of First Amendment rights in public schools since then has largely been one of decline and retrenchment, most recently in 2007 when the Supreme Court decided in the Morse case that a school could punish speech even outside of class time during a school-supervised off-campus event. Now the Supreme Court is being asked to consider student speech rights in the Internet age and whether students can be disciplined for off-campus online speech created on their personal time. The roller coaster ride of student First Amendment rights in public schools is chronicled in a terrific new book just out by author David Hudson. Let the Students Speak, A History of the Fight for Free Expression in American Schools. It's just been released this month by Beacon Press, and with us to discuss Let the Students Speak, how we got where we are on student speech rights, and where the Supreme Court might be heading is the author David Hudson. David is a graduate of Duke University and of the Vanderbilt University School of Law. He's a widely published author and commentator whose columns about the law of the First Amendment are available at www.firstamendmentcenter.org. Thanks so much for being with us, David, and for putting all this very valuable history down in one volume in Let the Students Speak. And just get us started by talking a little bit about why you chose as your focus the subject of student speech rights, talk also about the trajectory that student speech rights have been on since that high water mark of Tinker.
Yes, I've worked at the First Amendment Center for more than 15 years now, and during that time period, one of the most enjoyable parts of my work has been when I get to go to speak to groups of young people at high schools and middle schools. And so I developed an expertise in student rights, and it's something I felt very passionate about for quite a long time. And then also I had a student speech issue myself personally in high school. And so I think those two major factors contributed to me wanting to learn more about it. I certainly applaud the work of the Student Press Law Center. I've regularly read your website and your printed publications through the years. And so I became very, very interested in this area. It's sort of a nice, unique opportunity arose when Beacon unveiled this new free speech series, and I was approached to write the book on student speech. And when speaking about the trajectory, one of the most important or more interesting parts of the book project for me was to go back and look at a lot of the early student speech cases, which nearly uniformly ended in defeat for the students. But the fact patterns are very interesting. Some of them aren't too terribly different from student censorship cases that we see today. It's been very interesting for me to understand better the history of student speech, where you have sometimes some gains and then, like you mentioned earlier, some retrenchments.
I think there's a temptation maybe to assign relatively low value to student speech, so that there's a sense that when the school censors students' expression, maybe there's no great loss, and yet we don't indulge in that kind of a value judgment in weighing the value of adults' speech. Jersey Shore gets as much protection as Masterpiece Theater does. What is lost when student speech is censored? Is there something valuable that's really being lost?
Yes, it's the future leaders of our country. Schools are supposed to teach civic education, and it's very difficult to appreciate constitutional principles and their importance and their value in a constitutional democracy when you live in an environment that does not foster an appreciation of those principles. And that's that you've identified, I think, one of the great disconnects in First Amendment law, and that is, we do have greater free speech protections when the government acts as sovereign. But when the government acts as educator or employer or head of the military or as warden, then free speech rights are curtailed significantly. And unfortunately, student speech rights to a certain degree are based on an inmate model of protection. And frankly, so are public employee rights to a certain degree. So public school students, public employees, prisoners, and members of the military have a reduced level of First Amendment rights, and that's what attracts me to all four of those areas, actually. But certainly, I think the basic answer is that by curtailing student speech and student rights, we are failing to instill in the future leaders of the country a full appreciation of the values of these principles. And there's also, I think, a cynicism that arises between the disconnect or the dissonance between what I like to refer to as the ideal and the real. The ideal being adherence to the principles of the first 45 words of the Bill of Rights, and the real being the often speech repressive policies at various school districts across the country.
Well, one of the really cool parts of this book, Let the Student Speak, is that you were able to go back and gather information and interviews about some of the key players in free speech cases over the last 30 years, people like Joseph Frazier, whose case turned into the landmark Bethel v. Frazier case that enables schools to censor speech that they consider lewd. Do you have a favorite story or anecdote or experience to share from that gathering process?
Yes. Interviewed Matt Frazier, John Tinker, Christopher Eckhart through the years. I think I've interviewed Kathy Kuhlmeier of the famous Hazelwood case. But for this book specifically, I was able to communicate with Joseph Frederick of the Bong Hits for Jesus case. And that intrigued me for a couple reasons. One, I had never spoken with him before. Two, he was actually in China. We actually communicated a lot through email. And so I wanted to learn more about him. I found that case very fascinating. It's the most recent U.S. Supreme Court case on student First Amendment rights. So that certainly was one of my favorites. And another one of my favorites was, Tinker did not arrive in a vacuum. We often, I know I've been sort of guilty in the past of viewing Tinker as the seminal moment when students' rights were protected, but the Supreme Court didn't create the Tinker test out of a vacuum. It actually plucked it from some Fifth Circuit cases, including one that arose out of Philadelphia, Mississippi, Burnside versus Byers. And I was able to go back and interview one of the attorneys in that case, Henry Aronson, who talked about the bravery of the three African American mothers and their three young children who. It's almost amazing and mind-blowing for me to think of this, that they were challenging school officials in Philadelphia, Mississippi, the very city where you had those infamous murders of those three civil rights workers. So that was also a highlight for me.
One of the most interesting parts of the book is where you talk about some of the disciplinary overreactions that have followed after the horrible shootings at Columbine and at Virginia Tech, where in some cases you've seen students punished for just drawing cartoons that used violent images. Talk a little bit about the impact of those school shootings on the climate for student free expression.
Yeah, I mean, there's a definite Columbine effect on student expression. I think John Katz once referred to it as silencing the weird. Any violent themed student expression is now there's sort of a presumption that it's either a true threat or substantially disruptive under Tinker or somehow can be prohibited under a broad reading of Morse v. Frederick, the case that you mentioned. We've seen cases where kids have been thrown in jail for nothing other than writing essays. drawings. The 2-year-old drawing in the Adam Porter case out of the Fifth Circuit is one that I mentioned in the book. Admittedly, I have to balance that with the fact that Dylan Klybold wrote a very chilling essay in February of 1999 that drew a red flag for his English teacher, and then 2 months later he did, participate in with Eric Harris in the infamous shootings. But you're absolutely right. That horrible event was cataclysmic for student speech law. And it was cataclysmic in a negative sense because it did lead to many overreactions.
Well, you describe in the book the 1988 Hazelwood versus Kohlmeier case as, quote, the potential death knell for student rights. And of course, Hazelwood is a case everyone's familiar with that gives schools a somewhat freer hand to censor if the publication that students are writing is an official part of the school curriculum. Well, we now have over 2 decades of experience on the ground with Hazelwood. How do you see it being applied? And do you think that fear about the death knell for student rights has over time been realized?
Well, I feel a little funny telling you about Hazelwood. You're probably the premier expert on Hazelwood at the Student Press Law Center. But, Hazelwood to me, the thing I always am amazed about Hazelwood is that standard reasonably related to legitimate pedagogical concerns. Others have identified this as well, but it's very similar the year before the U.S. Supreme Court decided the prison inmate case, Turner v. Safley, involving, ironically enough, a Missouri inmate, Leonard Safley, who wanted to marry a female inmate and send her love letters. And so he challenged a couple policies from the Missouri Department of Corrections, one that banned inmate marriages and one that banned inmates sending mail to inmates in other institutions. And in that case, I think it was Justice O'Connor who wrote that, we do not impinge on the constitutional rights of inmates if prison officials, their reasons for doing so is reasonably related to legitimate penological concerns. So the standard for inmate First Amendment rights reasonably related to legitimate penological concerns, 1 year later in Hazelwood, with respect to school-sponsored student speech, we have reasonably related to legitimate pedagogical concerns. So they substituted the word pedagogical for penological. Ergo, with respect to school-sponsored speech, we have a model that's directly based on the rights of inmates. And that inmate model for student speech is anathema to a free society. I think what's really, the reason I view it as a death knell is if you go and back and look at Justice White's opinion in Hazelwood. I mean, it's just so breathtakingly broad what constitutes legitimate pedagogical reasons. Disassociating the school from any position other than neutrality on matters of political controversy. To me, that turns the First Amendment on its head, and I agree with Justice Brennan's characterization of that constitutes, quote, brutal censorship. And many courts, I think, when they apply Hazelwood, they do identify it as very deferential to school officials, and so unfortunately, it's often, although not always, but it's often when the Hazelwood standard is applied, there is a high probability that the student free speech claimant will lose.
Right.
I do reference the Katie Dean case, and so, there are some pockets, positive pockets, and of course, all of the work at the Student Press Law Center, I think, saves countless students in their battles with school officials, but certainly Hazelwood, and that's the great, one of the other great parts of your work is, battling for these, anti-Hazelwood laws and for schools to adopt policies that treat the papers more as open fora. But certainly Hazelwood is a negative precedent and one that I think we student speech advocates should continue to criticize.
Well, looking at the Roberts Court's one foray into the area of student speech rights, and you've already talked a little bit about this, about the Morse versus Frederick case. This is the case where the student holds up a sign with a nonsense message about bong hits across the street from his school, and the court finds the student's speech to be unprotected because it was said to be glorifying illegal drug use. I'm wondering now, with the hindsight of the last two terms of the Supreme Court, where we've seen such forceful reaffirmations of the First Amendment, even in cases where the speech is absolutely disgusting and offensive and hateful. Does that Morsi Frederick case sort of stand out as a particular anomaly now?
Not so much, because they viewed it as a school-sanctioned speech case. So while the Roberts Court has been good in certain areas of First Amendment law, and Snyder v. Phelps and the Brown versus Entertainment Merchants, since the Roberts Court classified it as a student speech case, I wasn't too terribly surprised. The Roberts Court has been terrible in public employee free speech rights, with the worst decision, I think, in First Amendment decision in recent memory, Garcetti versus Ceballos, which could be argued as a death knell for public employee, including public school teachers' First Amendment rights.
You're a public employee speaking about something that arose in the course of your duties, that's no longer First Amendment protected speech, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, Morse v. Frederick. There is one nugget, at least one nugget in Morse v. Frederick, though, I guess I do like, is when Ken Starr had argued for the school district that we should be able to prohibit Joseph Frederick's strange message because it's plainly offensive within the meaning of the Matthew Frazier case. And Chief Justice Roberts, to his credit, did reject that, saying that we think that stretches Frazier too far. After all, much political and religious speech could be considered offensive to some. So I did like the limitation of the Frazier standard, but he did recognize that there is some uncertainty as to the outer perimeters of when student speech is off campus. But on the other hand, you are correct that there's some certain dissonance between the court's decision in student speech law and public employee law with decisions in Snyder v. Phelps, United States v. Stevens, and Entertainment Merchants Association v. Brown.
Right. Well, we now have a number of cases that are bubbling up through the courts of appeal about the ability of schools to punish students' off-campus speech when the speech is posted on the Internet, and there are actually a couple that the Supreme Court is going to be asked to hear in its upcoming term. Of course, it has to decide whether to do so, but whether or not those particular cases get up to the Supreme Court or not, look into your crystal ball and kind of handicap for us. How do you think the Roberts Court is going to view these off-campus online speech issues? The first time a student gets before the court with a claim, let's say that he's been wrongfully punished under one of these many new cyberbullying laws that we're seeing.
Yes, you've asked a million-dollar question, and I don't know. I hate to speculate on what the court is going to do. Yeah, you've identified some dissonance between, for instance, there's some passages in EMA versus Brown that I believe you wrote about where, protecting the First Amendment rights of minors, and minors do have a significant amount of First Amendment rights, as Scalia said in the violent video game case. But you contrast that with what they did in Bong Hits for Jesus. Clearly, I do think we need some guidance on what is the proper standard. In some jurisdictions where school officials are loath to punish students for off-campus online speech, you do have the really unfortunate situations where, because, say, students are making negative comments about teachers and the school doesn't discipline the students, then you have teachers filing defamation suits against students, which is problematic. But on the other hand, we, as the Third Circuit said in the Layshock case, it would be an unseemly and dangerous precedent to allow school officials to go out and punish students for, purely off-campus speech. But you're absolutely right with the, cyberbullying being one of these, paramount issues in society. soon, I think the U.S. Supreme Court is going to have to take one of these cases, and I would like to reserve judgment until I saw the fully developed arguments and listened to oral argument. I am concerned as to what the Supreme Court would do. I do know that I think at least many members of the federal judiciary are taking notice. It was interesting to me that I was at a moot court competition, and there was a judge from the Seventh Circuit who made a comment that the problem that we had was a student internet speech case off campus, and the Seventh Circuit judge said that they were very interested in what the Third Circuit was going to do. And so I think that the issue is ripe or getting very ripe for review, and I think it won't be too – if it's not this term, it'll be very soon that we'll have one of those cases.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, just by way of wrap-up, we've talked about the downward trajectory of student rights since the 1960s, and it seems sort of anomalous for civil rights to actually go backward, but that's where we are. Is there anything that you see, whether it's a development of law or development of public opinion, or you see anything at all that give you reason to think that trajectory might change or might turn around?
Perhaps if you had a case involving what the court viewed as pure political speech, the censorship of a student for advocating pure political or religious speech under the right set of facts with a overreaching school administration, then you possibly could have a positive decision from this court. This court does recognize fact that viewpoint discrimination is generally anathema to the First Amendment. It does recognize that the First Amendment protects offensive speech, but it simply seems to treat public school student and public employee cases differently. It could be we might need someone on the court who often serves as an advocate for students. William O. Douglas could be argued was a justice like that for at least many years of his 36 plus tenure on the court. Okay. I'm not sure we have a Justice Douglas type on this current court that would be especially sensitive to student First Amendment rights.
Well, David Hudson, I want to really thank you for being our guest today and also for compiling all this wonderful research into your new book, which is just out on the stands. The book is called Let the Students Speak, A History of the Fight for Free Expression in American Schools. It's published by Beacon Press. And David Hudson of the First Amendment Center at Vanderbilt University, best of luck with this newly released book. For those of you listening, you can find the cases that we talked about with David Hudson, the Tinker case, the Morse case, and all of the Supreme Court's student speech cases in the Law Library section of the Student Press Law Center website, www.splc.org, as well as guides to help you understand and protect your own legal rights. We hope that you'll subscribe to the RSS feed for the SPLC's news alerts, that you'll join the Student Press Law Center's group on Facebook, and follow SPLC on Twitter. And if you're a student journalist or a journalism educator with any question about the law, call our hotline at 703-807-1904 or email us at splc@splc.org. Thank you for listening.